on paper, I was worth a lot of money in terms of real estate equity before the crash had hit. I remember one day waking up realizing it had happened gradually, but that I was on the brink of bankruptcy, depending on the mercy of these bankers, both of whom had my projects in what's called special assets at the bank, meaning they were not conforming and they needed special action from the bank. I was at the bank's mercy at any time, really, to have to declare bankruptcy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about the failures they've had in their lives and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. This week's guest is Case Lawrence, who is the founder and CEO of Circustrix. Case went from the brink of bankruptcy to found and lead a global trampoline park company with over 300 locations in just 7 years. As a commercial real estate developer in California, Case was decimated by the Great Recession of 2008. While he was trying to pull the pieces of his life back together, he visited a trampoline park in San Francisco with his sons, which inspired him to launch Circustrix. Circustrix provides extreme indoor recreational experiences by featuring trampolines, foam pits, ninja warrior courses, and trick and stunt attractions of all varieties. The company is now the largest owner, operator, and franchisor of trampoline parks in the world. In the episode, we cover quite a diverse array of topics. So Case discusses how he saved this commercial real estate company from the brink of bankruptcy in 2008, the strategies that he used during that dark time period in his personal life to cope with failure, how he expanded Circustrix from his humble beginnings to a global powerhouse in just 7 years, and why he believes early success can be a curse rather than a blessing. Before we get started, if you're enjoying Famous Failures, I would really appreciate it if you could please leave a rating on iTunes or Google Play and subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. And if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can get my free ebook, which is called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking, by going to my website at ozanvarol.com. That's O-Z-A-N-V as in Victor, A-R-O-L.com, or texting my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. You'll also get my weekly newsletter called The Weekly Contrarian every Thursday, which shares with you a list of tools, articles, books, gems that help you change the way that you view the world. Without further ado, here is Case Lawrence. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. As always, thank you for listening. Case, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure to be speaking with you. So I want to begin by traveling back in time to 2008, which, based on my research, in many ways was a pivotal year for you. So what were you doing at the time, if you can give some context to our audience here, and what happened?
It was a pivotal time. I was in Central California, and I was managing a commercial real estate development group and was actively involved in several big projects at the time. I had a storage concept. It was for small business. It was called Cargo Bay. We had developed our first facility in Clovis, California, and it had won the 2017 Storage Facility of the Year nationally. It was a great success and had been very well received. It was sort of a creative concept on storage where we were leasing out storage spaces, but also small offices to small business people, all on a credit card, all month to month. Those office spaces were fully furnished, and the storage units that we were renting out with those offices were geared towards small business people. So it was very well received, and we were excited to continue growing that across the country and had real estate tied up and ready to do that. So that was one big project that I had going on. And then the other was just Class A office space. I was developing an office park of over 200,000 square feet, had had early success with that. It was going well. So in 2008, I was, right up until then, you know, doing really well in commercial real estate. To even put a finer point on it, in 2007, when the financial crisis happened, I remember taking stock of my situation in commercial real estate. And, you know, there had started to be some rumblings that there was going to be some big problems. And I remember thinking and having the conversation with some of my partners and colleagues that that we were in a really good spot, that we would be okay because we'd been conservative, we had not been over-levered, and that all of our projects were cash flowing and performing very well. As we went into 2008, I was doing great and feeling great. And then really the recession and the financial collapse hit real estate.
And how did that affect your company?
It started out gradually, and really where it manifested itself was in what happened to the banks. And I think my example was very indicative of what was happening across the larger economy in the US. I worked primarily with two banks. One was a local California bank. One was a national bank. It started when, you know, I began to see the behavior changing with the banks. Both of my projects were young, and so they were still on what's called a development loan, meaning I had taken out a loan from the bank to develop and build the property and see us through the lease up time of each project. But the terms on these loans are usually very short, 3 years, sometimes 2 years with a 1 year extension. And the idea is that you need to get permanent financing to replace these development loans. And so both of my big loans that I had were with banks and they were development loans. And so both the banks I had been working with had given me all indication that they would like to refinance these projects I had and be the lender on my permanent financing. And I noticed they began to step away from that. And as it became time to more urgently pursue permanent financing as the terms on these loans were getting close to the end, what I found was that the real estate market had tanked so dramatically that it was impossible to get appraisals on these projects that would justify financing. To summarize a lot of behind the scenes banking language, what I can say is I was not able to get appraisals and therefore was not able to get loans of enough money to take out these development loans. And I was stuck without financing, even though both my big projects were performing very well, had leased up ahead of schedule. The banks were not interested in that. They just wanted these development loans off their books. And so the logic of the bank, all the banks I was dealing with, the logic really took a weird turn. And I think anyone who was in real estate at that time can relate to this. It was no longer a real reasonable business-oriented type of process that was happening. Instead, you had regulators taking over banks or at the minimum looking over the shoulder at bankers and requiring them to radically change their portfolios or divest of loans or move loans to special assets or categorize loans in a certain way. And so all the typical business logic went out the window. Bank regulators were running the real estate industry.
So you've got a business that requires or depends on permanent financing from banks. The banks are taken over by regulators, which puts you in a very tough position. So how did you deal with that? What did you decide to do?
Well, at first I thought it was just a matter of working harder and talking to a larger net of banks and possible finance partners. And so I did. What I found was as time went on, it got worse and worse. The sheer length of the recession, I think many who went through it can witness the same thing. I think a lot of people were in a position to weather it for 6 months, weather it for a year. But when it went on past that, you could see companies and real estate projects folding with every month. They weren't equipped to weather the length of the recession. You know, I kept working harder, but it also became more and more clear that there was not going to be a positive outcome to this. And despite how creative I got, bankers were in no mood to be creative. And really, they had no leeway to be creative. And that's when my discussions with the bankers and my own strategizing turned from trying to make these projects thrive to how do I land the plane and avoid personal bankruptcy? And that was quite a mental turning point for me, because on paper, I was worth a lot of money in terms of real estate equity before the crash had hit. And now, you know, I remember one day waking up realizing it had happened gradually, but that I was on the brink of bankruptcy and that depending on the mercy of these bankers, both of whom had my projects in what's called special assets at the bank, meaning they were not conforming and they needed special action from the bank, I was at the bank's mercy at any time really to have to declare bankruptcy. And that was a scary realization that that was not even really in my hands. And fortunately, you know, I had good relationships with the bankers I was working with. Although it was interesting, the national bank I was working with was taken over by the FDIC. Every month there was a new person. It was like a revolving door. There was a new person brought in by the bank to run their special assets. So you'd get a relationship with someone and then they'd be out the door and you'd have to start over with someone else and kind of create a whole new plan. And so that was frustrating. This all went on for about 2 years. As I look back on it and share the story, you know, I really spent 2 years of my career working for and with the banks, simply trying to avoid bankruptcy and try to land the plane, as it were, with these projects I had. I didn't earn a dollar during those 2 years, and I simply avoided bankruptcy, which fortunately I was able to do. And one of the big projects, you know, we ultimately were able to work out a what's called a deed in lieu in real estate, which is I basically gave the project back to the bank in exchange for them satisfying my obligations to the bank and not resulting in any sort of judgment against me or personal bankruptcy, which I considered a big victory at the time. And then in the second instance, I was able to kind of navigate and lead a short sale of this entire project that I had. And likewise, without any ongoing judgments or financial obligations on my part, which, you know, I didn't make a dollar on, but I'm grateful that I was able to do that. And I tell people to this day, no matter what else I accomplish in business, my greatest business accomplishment was avoiding bankruptcy during that 2 year period during the recession.
Yeah, that's a huge success. So you're on the brink of bankruptcy and you're at the bank's mercy in many ways as you're transitioning through this very thorny situation or dealing with this very thorny situation. Are there any particular strategies that you use to maintain your sanity and to land the plane safely, as you called it?
A lot of it was really a spiritual journey for me personally. You know, I think many people experience that when they go through something difficult, when their assumptions change radically and traumatically in their life. It really forces you to kind of get back to basics and consider what's important. For me, you know, it was my family and my faith. I'm very active in my faith. And I think that that whole period of time made me get closer to God. And I appreciate that. So I think that was another really positive outcome of that period of time in my life. And I think, you know, just personal strategies of just dealing with, you know, trying to prevent yourself from getting depressed and getting down and getting pessimistic. It's not easy. I think we all go through periods of time in our life where we can kind of drown in that. And I fought those same struggles during this period of time. I exercised a lot and prayed a lot, and some combination of all those things really pulled me through.
I think this brings us to the end of, close to the end of 2009. So how did you go from then closing down your commercial real estate company and then deciding to start a global trampoline park company? Because This looks like, at least on the surface, a pretty major transition there.
Yeah, you know, I'll never forget kind of my last meeting or last document I signed and leaving the bank and really feeling like $1 million, like this weight had been lifted from my shoulder, because I was done with these anchors that had been chaining me down for a couple of years. I was free. I felt a lot like Tom Hanks at the very end of Castaway when he's standing on this old country street in Texas or wherever it was, and he's really got nowhere to go and no life or obligations demanding anything of him. But the question is, what next? I felt that same way. And so I went through kind of a whole nother process, which was, what am I going to do next? And anyone in real estate during that time, it seems illogical now, but anyone during that time will tell you that there was really no prospect of continuing in real estate at that time. There just was nothing happening. And so that was not even an option. I'm an attorney by training and practice. I practiced for a few years. And so I thought maybe one option was to go back to the practice of law. And so I went and enrolled in several continuing education courses, and I reactivated my bar license in California. And I thought that's probably the most likely thing I would need to do. But it wasn't like law firms were were doing well during the recession either.
Sure, yeah.
So that, you know, the prospects there were fairly bleak. It was during that time that I went up to San Francisco to go to a Giants baseball game. I'm a big Giants fan, so are my boys. And we had a tradition that, you know, every spring we would go up and watch a spring game. And so we did. And a friend of mine at the time had said, hey, while you're up there, you ought to check out this place. It's really incredible. It's so unique and bizarre at the same time. You got to see it to believe it. It's a trampoline park. And I remember hearing the word for the first time and thinking, I can't even mentally envision what is inside a trampoline park. And before the game, I took my boys and we went to this place. It was at the Presidio. They were redeveloping the military base and had taken one of the hangars from the Presidio and turned it into a trampoline park. And it was one of the first trampoline parks in the country. There were maybe 7 or 8 in the country at this time. It was very new and unique. And I'll just never forget the experience my boys and I had at this trampoline park. It was this weird mashup of all these different things. It was physical exercise. You know, we were sweating and tired. It was musical. There was, you know, music playing. It was competitive. We were playing dodgeball with complete strangers, throwing dodgeballs at other people, which was just so weird, but cool. There was also, you know, this whole sensory part of it. There was art on the walls and the club music playing. And there was also just a social layer to it. People were there in groups with friends, laughing. I was there with my boys laughing. And the mashup of all these different factors just overwhelmed me. And I had a great experience with my boys. And so much so that we went to the game the next day. And then on our way home, we went back to the trampoline park. By the time I left that trip, so in really less than a 24-hour period, I was determined to go and do one of these myself. And I felt kind of this surge of confidence, like, I know how to do this. I've developed real estate. I'm an attorney. I can figure out how to get one of these up. And so that's what led to me starting and opening my first park in Madera, California. It was an adventure.
Any particular reason you picked Madera?
That was home.
Okay.
I was living in Clovis nearby. And then the other big reason was that was where I was able to find a building. And it was funny, I was working with a local real estate broker and I didn't really know what to tell him in terms of what kind of building. I just said, find something big with tall ceiling heights that we can put trampolines in. Even though I was a developer and a lawyer, I didn't really understand or appreciate what challenges might come up from a zoning or use allowance perspective. I just didn't have any real thought about that. And the broker ended up finding me this building and it was only 12,000 square feet, which by today's standards is just so small. We just recently opened the biggest park in the US in Seattle. And that park is 65,000 square feet.
Wow.
So this first one was 12,000 square feet. So you can imagine how small. You know, I didn't have any money. I had lost everything in the recession. So the most urgent question was how I was going to pull the capital together to get this thing open. And I borrowed money. I brought on a partner. To this day, I can't believe I was able to talk our landlord into advancing tenant improvement money to buy trampolines, which is not a typical tenant improvement, as you can imagine.
Sure, so, yeah.
So I just laugh at that now because there's no way I'd ever be able to do that again. And I did creative deals with the contractors. You know, there were a lot of construction people who didn't have a lot of work during that time. I got creative with that and had arrangements with several of them to do work and to get paid after the park had opened on a installment basis. Something, again, I'd never be able to talk any sane person into doing again. So long story short is I got as creative as possible to get this thing open. And I'll never forget the total capital required to open that first park was about $431,000. I still have the spreadsheet on my laptop right down to the dollar. So we got it open. It was small, it was cheap, but it was successful. Today, to give you an example, many of our parks cost upward of $3 million to complete. They've come a long way, but that's a little peek into that first one. And that first park was called Skywalk, located in Madera, California. And I was just so grateful to get it open.
I think this happens to a lot of people, but whenever we're transitioning into a new field, we're afflicted by the imposter syndrome. And so, you know, you had a lot of experience as an attorney, then the owner of a commercial real estate business, but this is pretty different from what you've been doing before. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. I mean, was there any negative self-talk going on at the time in terms of whether or not you're cut out to start this new business? And if there was any negative self-talk, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I think there was, it was a little different than the imposter mindset, which I think it's interesting you bring that up. And the reason is I was working here in an industry that really was not established at all.
Right.
It was non-existent. And so that may have actually been a benefit in regard to avoiding that imposter syndrome, because it wasn't like there were any examples or anyone else who'd been in this industry. It was the exact opposite. It was a total desert and I was alone. If anything, it was really the opposite. There was some self-talk of, Case, you've got a law degree. You've worked for one of the best law firms in the country. You've been a successful real estate developer. You've got a family at home. What are you doing messing around with trampolines? You know? So it was kind of more like, what has my life come to that I've resorted to trampolines? You know, that was really the temptation on the negative self-talk. But interestingly, I may have been helped from that, you know, imposter syndrome because of the nature of the industry I was in.
And what was your response to that self-talk about what are you doing with trampolines?
It really was overcome by desperation. And that's why, you know, I'm really grateful to this day. I don't think I would have, all of those reasons would have kept me from really taking this seriously if it had not been for just the pure desperation of providing for my family. And in my case, it was especially urgent. My wife and I had just had our sixth child, you know, so the weight of providing for my family was really heavy. And as we prepared to open Skywalk, this first park, I remember creating a whole little pro forma on an Excel spreadsheet and going over it with my wife. I remember saying, look, if everything goes right, if this happens, and these are all assumptions, but if everything goes right, I think we could possibly clear $5,000 a month from this business. And if we can do that, that would be a lifeline to our family to survive while I figure out what to do with the rest of my life. I was originally thinking of it as just a temporary lifeline to try to get some cash flow to feed my family. I'll never forget the second weekend that we were open, and it was late on a Saturday, and I had the point of sale software up on my laptop, and I was watching as we got closer to close, and the place had been sold out all day. I'll never forget, it was at about 9 p.m. that it hit $11,000 for the day we pulled in. I remember this just deep satisfaction. And the first thought that came to my mind was, I think we're going to clear that $5,000.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, it really was desperation driving me during that first phase.
So you began with this initial facility in Madero, and then you went from that to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but over 300 locations in just 7 years?
Yeah, that's true. And it's really an interesting thing to look back on because I can see the different motivations along the way as I look back. And as I mentioned, the motivation to do the first one was pure desperation. But after I got that first one going, I had some cash flow and my life kind of normalized a little bit from a financial standpoint. And I also had a chance to sort of understand this business and realize that there was a lot of demand and a lot of consumer love for what we were providing. And that's when one day the neighbor of this facility, so there was a house right behind the Skywalk where this first park was. And the neighbor, we had tried to reach out to the neighbors because we felt bad. We knew that we were playing loud music sometimes on the weekend and worried that we might annoy the neighbors. So I'd reached out to each of them and they were all just great people, very understanding. But one day, one of those neighbors came and stopped into Skywalk and asked to talk with me. And he said, look, I live right behind here. I watch the cars. I drive past the cars every day and see how many customers you have here. I can tell something special is happening here. And he said, my wife and I, he had run a commercial construction company and likewise had been really devastated by the recession. And he said, my wife and I would like to move to the East Coast. And we likewise, like myself, need to find a new career. And we're wondering if you would be interested in partnering with us to do one of these on the East Coast. So we started talking, and he really had no place in mind. And I actually had been to law school in Durham, North Carolina. So I suggested, you know, the Raleigh-Durham area. And they both liked that idea. And within a couple of weeks, they were out there scouting and looking for homes and buildings for trampoline parks. And that presented to me kind of the first moment of truth in my entrepreneurial journey. Because like I said, before that, I was desperate. So I had to do something, and I was driven by that desperation. Now I was faced with an opportunity to risk what I had established with this first park at Skywalk. In other words, I had some monthly cash flow and had even been able to save up a little money from our strong start. And now I was faced with the choice of whether I was going to roll the dice and put everything I had, including this monthly cash flow that I now had, at risk to start another one. And basically put every spare dollar I had into this new park in North Carolina. And so I had a little bit of soul searching at that time. And I finally, I'm glad I did, decided to go ahead and take the risk and roll the dice and open that second park in North Carolina. And, you know, it was the same thing. Within a week, we were sold out. And there was just absolute euphoria about the park and about the trampoline park concept. And at that point, I knew we were onto something. And that these parks would succeed, not just in Central California, not just in North Carolina, but that if we could get them open, people wanted to have them and that they would succeed.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your decision-making process with respect to that second park. Because as you said, it was a risky move. You know, you could have doubled down on what you had in Madera, California. What led you to roll the dice on that park in North Carolina?
I think by that point, it got down to a more logical reasoning process. And it also got down to the fact that I was really enjoying my first park and being in the business, the trampoline park business in Central California, and what I had learned and experienced there. And I could kind of hold that up and say, gosh, it still seems unlikely that I could turn this into a career. But if I can get two of these up or three of these up, I might be able to do this for a while. And gosh, this would sure beat practicing law. There began to be a budding passion for the business and for the joy and the impact that it had in the community. I was really surprised by that. You know, the business of fun, ultimately, I was having fun. And so I think that what got me over the hump on that second one was just the pure love and joy of the concept. And so I really enjoyed it and had a lot of fun. And that really became even stronger as I moved on to the third and fourth and fifth one. I really enjoyed the creative aspect of coming up with new ways to lay these parks out, new attractions to put in the parks, the treasure hunt of looking for buildings where you could potentially put one of these parks. All of it was just very intoxicating. And pretty soon I was full time and had no doubts that this is what I wanted to do for the foreseeable future.
So taking circus tricks from these initial two locations into the leader in the extreme recreation park arena. Since the show is about failures, I have to ask, and that's a huge accomplishment, but were there any failures along the way and any, you know, valuable failures that stand out for you in building and growing Circus Tricks?
On a regular basis, there have been. You know, our business is a great example of this in sort of a microcosm. Because one of the things that we have to do is we have to continually roll out new attractions into these parks. And so there's a continual thought process of what's the new thing we could do that would be popular in a park. And we've had a lot of successes. Our company, Circus Tricks, was sort of the first to really roll out the Ninja Warrior obstacle course on a broad basis. We invented a trapeze attraction that was modified for an indoor foam pit use in our parks that has been very popular. We've even come up with an indoor zip line. No one thought that would be possible, and we were able to do that in a safe, indoor, modified way. So we've had some great success with these attractions we've rolled out, but we've also had some just epic failures. And you know, there have been a couple attractions that we've rolled out that have just fallen flat and no one has liked them and they've been abject failures. So one of which was a probably appropriately named. It was called Dead Man's Drop. And the idea was we were going to, it was almost like a casket and you would lay down in it and a button would push and it would drop you over a foam pit. And unfortunately that fell not into a foam pit. It just fell flat into failure. And so that was one of them. We've more recently rolled out a parkour attraction, which parkour is very, very popular in Europe. And we really thought we were ahead of the curve and that we could be, you know, the first mover and the leader in adding a real sophisticated parkour element to our parks. And so we did, and it failed miserably. We were out ahead of the zeitgeist of American culture. We were too far ahead. And so no one was using it. And that was a failure. So we continue, and I think we will continue to have attraction failures, but that's part of the creativity that, you know, is required to keep our business fresh and keep coming up with new stuff, is you can't be afraid to fail and put something out there for the public to try and consume and either like or dislike.
And how do you decide what innovative attractions you end up pursuing? Like, do you do any testing before you actually roll out the attractions?
We do as much testing as we can. Given the physical nature and the static, stationary nature of these attractions, it's hard to do them on a real widespread basis. You know, you can kind of do them in a limited geography. And I think that's one of the problems is you tend to get confirmation bias and you tend to really get testing from a core group of people who love these parks. And so I think the times we have failed, I think that's what's happened is really a case of confirmation bias and not having as broad a sample of trial before we rolled it out.
And are there any particular strategies that you use in trying to bolster creativity in the decision-making process to actually come up with an idea that could take off?
We are in a very creative business, and it starts for us by talking to our customer. And in our case, a customer is not a parent, it's a teenage kid, and really trying to get in their mind and understand what they like and what they're intrigued by, what they're watching on YouTube, what they're seeing on social media, and really trying to get suggestions from them about what they like and what they're interested in. And then adding the additional layer of how can we bring these things to bear in an indoor environment and in a safe way? And that becomes a creative challenge. It's amazing how many things that, you know, just you sort of mash them up. And the example I'll give to you is the slackline. Slacklining has been around a long time and popular following. There's professional slackliners. It's a great outdoor recreation pursuit and has been around for a long time. Well, what we did is we said, what if we took a slackline and we put it over a foam pit and put it in an indoor environment? And no one had really ever done that. So we tried it and it was very successful. And people who'd never slacklined before and probably wouldn't normally were able to participate in that in our parks in a safer, controlled environment. So a lot of it is just sort of mashing up ideas that already exist and mashing them up with the confines and the safety and the controlled environment of a trampoline park.
Are there any parting words on failure that you'd like to share with the audience to the extent that there is advice, strategies, thoughts that didn't come up already that you'd like to leave our audience with?
I think failure is one of the, if not the most important prerequisite to being successful. And what I mean by that is if you don't fail and have meaningful failures, it's really hard to ever appreciate success. And I don't mean that as a cliche. You know, to be successful with success requires an appreciation for how hard it is to achieve it and for other experiences that didn't lead to success. And so, you know, I appreciate what we've built here at Circus Tricks all the more because of my failures. I wouldn't trade them. They're some of the most valuable points of meaning in my life and in my story and in my history and in what I've been able to build here now. Embrace failure. We don't strive for it, but I think we need to embrace it in the sense of just pulling all the meaning and learning we can out of it and all the motivation we can out of it. I think that's the other thing is, I think my experience during the recession and my failures there really motivated me to keep growing when some entrepreneurs in the trampoline park space were content to do one park or two park or three parks. I think my failures during the recession really drove me to keep going. And that's what really propelled us to be able to grow to the scale that we've been able to grow. I don't think that would have happened without my failures during the recession.
That's such an important point. And I think a corollary to that is that early success can be a curse rather than a blessing.
Yes.
In the sense that, you know, you could become complacent. That could really boost egos and think that, you know, make you think that you're invincible, essentially. And you see that with a lot of early career successes, whether they're child prodigies in some area or child actors or even best-selling authors who hit it big with their first book. That tends to set them up for later failure, and not having experienced that failure early on, not only are they ill-equipped to deal with it, but they grow complacent very quickly and they don't work as hard as they should.
You know, having gone through the process of having success here with Circus Tricks, I totally can witness to that exact thing. And I feel very grateful that I did not have success, ultimate success, earlier, because I just don't think I would have been able to appreciate it as much and really appreciate what the cause and effect of it and the dynamics that drove it. Being a successful entrepreneur requires humility, because you need to be confident, but you need to understand how much luck, you know, the timing, all of those things, how important those factors are in what you do. And if you treat those lightly, I think you're unlikely to be successful ultimately. So yeah, you know, humility as an entrepreneur is important. You have to have confidence. But I think the humility to fail and keep learning and keep trying and just appreciate that is so important.
Thank you so much, Case, for joining us and for sharing your very inspiring entrepreneurial journey. Where can the audience find out more about Circus Tricks?
The best place to start is to find Circus Tricks on the web at circustricks.com. That's Circus Tricks with an X.com. And of course, our social media channels on Facebook or Instagram. And we have a lot of great videos on YouTube as well.
Excellent. We will include all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much again, Case, for joining us and for such a great conversation.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed talking with you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.